Hi, everybody. This is Armand DeMille with you with The Positive Mind here on WBAI 99.5 FM. Bringing ideas, concepts, and guests help you lead a more positively minded life. And today we have something fascinating. The subject is eavesdropping. The author, John Locke. John Locke's in the studio with us, John. John, welcome to WBAI.
Thank you very much.
Good to be here.
And with us also, Linda Vanella.
Thank you.
Who found this interesting. You read the book as well, right, Linda?
Yes, I have, Armand.
All right, let's talk about this. Eavesdropping. First of all, where does the word come from?
Well, it's an architectural term, in fact. In England, where this practice first, I suppose, was named in English, eavesdrop refers to the place on the roof of the house where rain falls off to the ground. And you may have seen a little line sometimes in the ground just below the roof line where the rain falls. And eavesdroppers were people who stood in that space in order to hear or to see what was going on inside.
And would there be any advantage to being in that spot as opposed to any other spot?
No, I think that the English housing in the 14th, 15th, 16th centuries was pretty flimsy. And if you just stood somewhere outside the door,
you could hear just about everything.
Yeah.
Eavesdropping. I thought it had something to do with pigeons, but I'm glad. I'm glad it's got a better order. So people, it seems, we have this ability to and desire to listen in on other people.
We surely do. There's not much question, I think, that we all have this this appetite to know what's going on in the lives of other people, especially those spaces in lives where they would just as soon be private.
Is it just to fill space, or is there some kind of an impulse, some kind of a desire, some kind of a genetic survival mechanism listening in?
I think so. I think fairly clearly an evolutionary origin to this particular appetite. It's found throughout the animal kingdom. Other animals simply cannot survive. If they don't know what their prey are doing or where they are, they can't survive without knowing about predators or even competitors within their own species. They've got to keep tabs on what others are up to, and frequently the most important information in the animal kingdom and in our own human lives is material that others would not freely donate to us.
I was listening to something about bird calls the other day, and how bird calls are not only the distress calls of the birds themselves, but the other birds listen to the distress calls of other species of birds for information.
Yes, that's true. There's a wonderful example in the Galapagos Islands of lizards that do this. They themselves cannot see their predators, aerial predators, so easily. There are hawks there that prey upon them. But they can overhear the calls of other birds that have the same hawk predators, and they use that as a signal. And whenever they hear mockingbirds scream out an alarm call, the iguanas head for cover.
So this is kind of like a very interesting thing to have been built into our survival mechanisms, because to be able to listen in on that which was not directed to you, it's kind of what we're talking about, right?
It is. And it manifests itself nowadays. It expresses itself as a form of theft. And we're quite aware that we are taking something that isn't intended for us. But we need to have this kind of information.
Strange that it comes up now with all WikiLeaks and all that, with Assange and all that's happening, because the big question comes up, is it all public information or not? A little earlier, I was talking to a couple where the wife listened in on her husband's email, finding him addressing romantic stories to other women. And I said, it used to be a time when this was all private. And it's not private anymore. And maybe this whole idea that everything should be transparent is coming around at the moment. I'm not sure. Because everybody seems to be listening to everybody else.
There have been waves of changes in the boundary lines between public and private. Our own ancestors lived in complete transparency, and they did so not because they had no choice. They did so because they coveted transparency. They wanted it. They went out of their way to achieve it. They had entire jungles and deserts to live in, and they chose to live together in clumps. And they organized themselves so that they could see each other 24 hours a day. They had the building capacity and the materials and tools to construct houses, refused to do so.
Which ancestors are these?
I'm thinking, we have to reconstruct.
Are you talking about simian ancestry? Or?
We're talking about all human ancestors prior to the construction of walls, really. Nomadic groups spent each night frequently in a different place, or at least seasonally moved from place to place. And they probably didn't pay for them to put much energy into the construction of dwellings, but they didn't want dwellings. Even when they made them, they tended to sleep and eat in front of their little huts. And they became nervous when somebody left the view of others. And they had a good reason for that. This is all strictly functional stuff. Somebody absented him or herself, the concern was what we might ask, let's say, of a child or teenager in our own home, what are they doing in there that they can't do out here?
Mm-hmm.
And that mattered to them because those were all egalitarian societies that shared food. That was their main concern, was sharing food and also protecting themselves against wild predators. They needed each other. They had to hang together, and they had to see each other together with them.
So having the belief that you desire transparency is not just an ethical belief. It's not, I want to be an honest man. It's that I am in agreement with everybody in my group that we will all be honest men. We will all be seen. Everything will be heard. Nothing will be private.
Yeah, I mean, in a sense, you raise an interesting point with the word honest and perhaps its kindred term, trust.
Mm-hmm.
You can't actually be honest or be trustworthy if you're under view 24 hours a day. Those are things that extend to people that are not visible. I suspect they really weren't well-developed concepts in prehistory. But all this got disrupted when they began to build houses. And that was probably preceded by a switch over from nomadicism to kind of an agricultural culture where they we're all living in settlements, and it then made sense to have houses, and they built.
I used to think it was all the lawyers that made us unhappy. Now I believe it's the architects. Blame the architects, right, for putting up walls.
And you know, the people resisted them. It's very interesting. You'd think, oh, my, at last, privacy. Now I'm free of all these people staring at me 24 hours a day. It was just the opposite. And we know because there are other societies that have been in transition in recent years, and anthropologists have described their living habits. And the houses that were built frequently had no doors, and even if they did have doors, people were told or instructed basically to remain out in full view. They did treat privacy as secrecy. Why are you in there? Life is out here. This is where we are. Why are you gone? And we have very good information about that. Hmm. So there's quite a resistance to this whole matter of privatization.
There's been a recent shift among many corporations, I'm aware of one in particular, to move from having the private offices to having the open floor with the stalls. And every now and then I call one of my friends who works in these companies and he says to me, I can't talk out loud because people hear me next door. He actually has to whisper because it's so unprivate.
That was the complaint when open plan officing began. You can look back in the early 60s, I think, when this really began to take hold. And people by then, of course, had already acquired a natural taste for private privacy and were very afraid that their conversations would be overheard.
But now people have just adjusted to that. I won't do a private conversation here. I'll take my cell phone outside to call if necessary.
Well, I think one of the concerns that rail passengers have is where is privacy? We're overhearing conversations we don't want to overhear. And it's as though people have taken public space and decided that they can treat it as private space.
This is Armand DeMille. I'm with John Locke, who wrote a fascinating book called Eavesdropping. He talks about the intimate history of eavesdropping. John, let's talk about frison.
Okay,
frison. Good new word.
Well, I think that it comes to our attention when we're in a position, whether we put ourselves in that position or simply find ourselves in situated where something's going on that we have an opportunity to monitor, or a space in someone's life that we can, with our senses, enter. We know that this is wrong. We've been taught as children to mind our own business. We've been told that we shouldn't stare. And we recognize a possibility to mind someone else's business. And so we find ourselves, in some sense, leaving our own identities with our eyes and ears, kind of sensing our way into the lives of another person, of other people. And when we do that, there is a sense, I think, that we're doing something naughty, and that gives us that sense that of a frisson, of a bit of a thrill, perceptual thrill.
So frisson is a perceptual thrill based on doing something that you think you shouldn't be doing.
We know we shouldn't be doing it in the sense that we've been taught that, but we also know that if we are discovered, the experience will stop. One of the things I love to look at in my spare time is the photos taken by street photographers, whose work is only appreciated to the extent that they've caught people unawares. There is something in that moment, something Susan Sontag wrote about it. There's something, she said in her book on photography, that on the face of a person who doesn't know he's being observed, that never appears when he does. There's something almost, I think of it as being almost noble about a person bearing a sense of himself. Maybe a person is preoccupied planning his or her next move, and we sense there's a dignity about them. The moment they see us, it's gone. It's almost as though they're frightened, that they now realize the possibility of an interaction has arisen. We might speak to them. We might address them in some way. They're no longer just them anymore. They're the person in social anticipation.
One of the things I've always enjoyed about sitting at a Starbucks window is that people don't realize that it's a window. And so they're passing by. And then what they do is they use the glass as a mirror to kind of make themselves a little neater. But then as soon as they see me looking, they say, oops, now they just have to change character. So the frisson is the feeling that I'm doing something a little naughty, illegal, forbidden, and that if it'll come to an end, this feeling will come to an end, this excitement will come to an end if I get discovered, then I have shame instead, then I have this whole other thing. But now this relates, of course, to eavesdropping, because eavesdropping, I guess the same as voyeurism? Is it? I mean, there must be a close similarity between the two, don't you think?
I suppose there is on some level. I tend to avoid equating eavesdropping with voyeurism because it strikes me as being a largely male-oriented and sexually-oriented activity. And there's obviously a link there of some sort, but it takes us away from, I think, the more recreational eavesdropping that all of us do in waiting rooms and various places where there are people to be seen.
You know, there was a popularity of eavesdropping devices that were these little headphones that you wear where you could hear somebody 50 feet away talking. And they never became popular, whereas telescopes certainly did become popular, didn't they?
Yes, they did. in fact, in New York, it was pointed out some years ago in an article in the New Yorker magazine that the sale of telescopes in New York City per week suggests that astrology is not our only interest.
There's a so there are professional eavesdroppers. They're called spies.
There are.
There are scouts.
There are.
There are.
There have always been.
And there are people you send out and say, well, listen in and tell me what you hear.
Sure.
And they have to come back to you. I wonder if we had that back in when we were walking around the Serengeti, if we ever did.
Well, there's always been the curiosity because people did absent themselves, even though they weren't supposed to. And people would follow them back into the bushes, and sometimes they followed footprints, and when they did, they sometimes found butt prints. And the word quickly came back to the village that there was an assignation in the jungle. I think that if you look across the various cultures of the world, almost all of them have a game called hide-and-seek.
Mm-hmm.
And it's ostensibly played by children. But I think that throughout our life, there's always an active quest to know what's going on. And there will always be an attempt to thwart those efforts by hiding.
And embarrassment, of course, when you do get discovered. I mean, the worst thing that could happen is someone passes gas in public and everybody pays attention to you. And you say, I didn't do it. You know, the other guy did it. It's kind of what you... But it's a... It's... You couldn't help it.
There's an interesting thing about that. sometimes when you think of the things you wouldn't like to be caught doing, you would probably make a list of things that are considered really, really wrong, but morally or legally wrong. But think of your embarrassment if you were simply being yourself at home and doing something that you do at home. And somebody walked by and observed you at that moment. I think, for example, some music on the radio and it's an orchestra and you decide you'd like to direct it, and you do so, and where you put on an old army uniform and snap a salute into the mirror, these are things that people might do in private. If you were seen doing that, you'd feel extreme embarrassment. You'd almost feel if it was a friend, you'd have to go out and tell them, well, I was just doing this. And if you couldn't explain it away somehow, in a way, that person would have something on you. It wouldn't be blackmail, but it would be knowledge that you of what you were like in a moment of an unguarded moment. Maybe you'd call it a moment of vulnerability or a moment of weakness. And I think I write in the book about what I call gray mail, which is not blackmail. It's just something that you've seen that tilts the balance. If that were your employer or a superior, now you might be a little bit more powerful than you used to be in that relationship.
And if you are the employee, you're that much weaker.
Yeah.
Because you're seen.
Yes.
I often wonder how they. Of course, you understand why they have different toilets for the executives than they do for the rest of the people, because it's something about you're not supposed to get me that part of my privacy. You're not supposed to get to that. It's a funny thing. Television, radio programs. How does the broadcast industry tie into the need for eavesdropping?
Well, it's their lifeblood.
I know.
I mean, if you go back to the beginning of the media, it almost has that as its origin. If you don't mind, I'll drop back a couple of centuries to Pamela, the romance novel published in England, really seemingly the first or close to the first. people couldn't get enough. They'd never seen anything in print that related to intimacy, they were really caught up with it. And the romance novel industry, very swiftly, as soon as electronics made it possible, moved into televised and the film industry. The first people that went to films commented that they felt a little bit guilty about watching people on the screen who didn't realize they were being watched, even though they were actors who had made the movie. We had to be kind of conditioned to all this, that these glossy photo magazines, the soap operas, reality TV. The thing that's interesting about the sort of appetite for this experience is that it's a very flexible muscle. It shifts with the times.
What do you mean? What kind of shifts have you taken place?
Well, if you let's take the social media, people have become so privatized. There's virtually nobody left to see when they're home. Neighborhood watch is almost like a daring idea for lots of people. They're not about to sit out on the stoop and watch the street. And so we have begun to pipe out information about ourselves on wires, and seemingly shocked that it could be intercepted. What an odd reaction. Of course, this is what used to happen. You would leave your house and people would see you. They would stop and talk to you. They would see who you were stopping and talking to and so forth. So now we're sort of sending out little bits and pieces of ourselves in cyberspace. And again, there's this feeling of this material has been taken by others. I didn't intend for them to have it. But whenever you donate information about yourself, you know, it's like putting something in writing. You should just never do that. But I think it's not going to stop. In fact, it's going to go the other way, because I don't think anybody wants to get to the end of their life and realize that nobody knows that they existed. That if you look at the way obituaries are used in societies, that this is the worst possible thought, that you would die and nobody would come to your funeral, or that nobody would know that you exist. And so people are now putting out their own press releases, in effect, their own sort of photo ops, and saying, okay, here I am. And but they're thinking, I want this to fall only into the eyes of, to be seen and heard only by certain people. And they're shocked when other people get it. That wasn't the plan. But that's not the way it works. It's hard to be selectively transparent.
Well, since people like to eavesdrop, and that's obvious, do you think people like to be eavesdropped upon? Now, eavesdrop rather than putting out information. Like, I wonder sometimes when there's somebody on a cell phone who's saying something so loud that he seems to want everybody to hear it.
Yeah, I think that the cell phone business on the telephone is sort of one thing, because they're acting like, if I may say so, they don't give a damn. it's almost in your face or in your ear, and they almost dare you to pay attention to it. But I think that people generally are upset when they realize that others are tuning into some aspect of their life that they are not intending to be known. The difference, I think, between photo ops, which is what we really prefer, where we basically present ourselves in the way we want to present ourselves. We're like little publicists for our own beings, and we want those to be taken advantage of. It's like your resume or your CV. You put in there what you want to be known about you. But the moment you recognize that somebody's peering into the inner portions of your life, this is a different matter altogether. This is where vulnerability resides.
And there's something about vulnerability that we would rather hide. We would rather not have available to other people.
Yeah, and there are some, I think, some gender differences here. I think men who pride themselves on being autonomous are really afraid that somebody will find out what they're really like when the mask is off. And that's why I think frequently women complain in relationships that they can't get men to talk to them about their lives, about the things that they deeply care about. That's exactly what men don't want anyone to know about, because then they lose control. Now, anybody that knows this can stop the Autonomy Act anytime they want. Women feel, I think, rather differently about that, and there are many other gender differences, I think.
But there's also, you know, if you think about the Cold War in the 60s, the Cold War was, how big is your weaponry? How big is your weaponry? I mean, it couldn't be more primitive than that. Mm. You know, and we are trying to say, I want to listen in on yours and find out how big, how many ships you have, mm-hmm. how many guns you have. And that became a basis of a whole societal movement. I mean, this is what we did. This is what we did to find out. It was like this, I don't know if it's just male or if the whole world is male-like in that way. You know, there was no transparency between the countries.
Yeah, it is like an arms race with regard to control over information. And that's what we have today, isn't it? It's all about info. That's perhaps the greatest fear we have in America and perhaps in other modern countries is that our communication systems will somehow become corrupted by terrorists. You know, cyber terrorism. Good heavens. I mean, the world would come to a stop, wouldn't it?
Well, yes. I'm hearing a lot of questions in my mind about general etiquette, John, when you're speaking about men and women, and, of course, that person who's speaking loud on the cell phone. And I can see where that public self and that private self is so oftentimes so questionable, whether it be in a Starbucks or out on the street where, you know, you'll see that person speaking on the cell phone almost wanting everyone to know about their private life. And on the other hand, people who will take offense to that. So I feel like there's almost a question of when we're talking about privacy and public self, private self, and an etiquette question comes to hand here.
Yes. And it's sort of rapidly shifting etiquette, isn't it? Someone asked me recently about this, and I said, well, you know, between the time you finish asking it and the time I finish answering, the boundary may have shifted additionally. It's on everyone's mind, isn't it? What an odd society we live in today where we have such consciousness of who knows about me and what do I know about others? And will this be seen and will that be heard? It's on television all day. It's in the papers. This rapidly and sort of ambiguously shifting boundary between public and private.
My guest is John Locke, L-O-C-K-E. The book is Eavesdropping, which I am sure is going to become very popular very soon. Nice Christmas present. And we'll be taking your calls as well at 212-209-2900. Let's hear what you have to say about it. What about you and eavesdropping and listening in, and how does that feel to you? So we will be back to address some of these questions right after our break, but of course there will be, as usual, a little music. This is Armand DeMille with you at The Positive Mind. We're with you only Tuesday this week, thanks to some changes at WBAI. And how are those changes working for you? Are they good, not so good? Let us know. I will be back with you the following week, but on Facebook you can always catch the filling-in programs that we're now doing. So there'll be a Wednesday and Thursday fill-in on Facebook just for you guys, in case you miss it. We're going to take a short break. When we come back, a little music, and then we'll take your calls at 212-209-2900. We'll be right back.
I bet you're wondering how I knew. I'm sure.
it through the grapevine, Marvin Gaye. That's about as essentially eavesdropping as we could get. Hearing it through the grapevine, gossiping. This is Armand DeMille with you with the Positive Mind. Our telephone number here is 212-209-2900. Back in the society pages, there was always a phrase, what will the servants say? There was a concern among people who were of the so-called upper crust of what kind of messages the servants, the people who served them, would say to each other about you. That what you wanted to do was control how people gossip about you by behaving in ways that made you unbreachable. Now, a lot of people feel that way about their employment, too. Once in a while, they'll find somebody has a Christmas party and they get drunk at a Christmas party and they kind of reveal parts of themselves that they feel, well, it was only a Christmas party. But, you know, it's a great embarrassment and it follows you. It goes with you. Because when people see parts of you that you don't show normally, they record it. It's a record. There used to be a day, I remember, when if you looked at somebody who was doing something, they could turn to you and say, what are you looking at? As if you have no right to look at me. Nowadays, when people are on cell phones, do you think they have a right to say, what are you listening to? Why are you listening to me? Any day now, if you wear perfume and somebody, what are you smelling? See, I think we want to be eavesdropped. I think we want to be known. I think we don't like the need to keep things private. Think about Facebook. Facebook, instant messaging. It's the absolute eavesdropping. Absolute. I'm going to the grocery store now. I mean, you want people to know this? Yes. Why? And why is it so popular? Because there's a need for it. 212-209-2900. We're going to take your calls just in one more minute. The favorite of all eavesdropping, the thing that people like to overhear the most, they want to overhear about other people's affairs, sexual relationships with other people. They want to know about adultery. Adultery is the most common, popular eavesdrop. It's the most form of gossip, and it's also the thing you want to learn about. That's why you're listening in on things. Can I get hints of this? 212-209-2900. Let's take one of your calls. This is Armand DeMille. Hi, you're on the air.
Hello.
Hello there.
John.
Hi, John.
Yes. Are you saying this is a growing problem or that it's reaching critical mass at this point?
I'd say both. I'd say both. What do you think?
Well, I come from the country. I'm a country person, and this is a problem that plagued me all my life. Because in the country, the social norm was that good fences make good neighbors. There were certain, mm-hmm. there were definite boundaries. Even though we didn't have any money, we still had these social boundaries. And when I came here, it just like I was completely in the middle of everyone just on top of me, just, you know, just interested in whatever I was doing.
So now, you could say that's, your name is John?
Yeah.
John, so you would say that's the nature of being from the country to the city, but you're also a private person, aren't you?
Well, but that was part of growing up in the country where
but
we
I don't
had
think
land.
All country people, I don't think all country people
no,
are private
No, we had
people.
Land, and when we were self-sufficient.
Yes.
So our development was individual.
Yeah, it's quite a difference.
Yeah, and plus we had Christian law for 1,600 years.
Yeah.
And that was a factor there where we weren't supposed to be interested in other people. We were supposed to be interested in the divine rather than the human. Yes, transcendence was essentially the social norm.
So does it bother you a great deal that people are so aware of your business?
Well, yeah, of course, because it caused me a great deal of psychological damage when I was growing up. I grew up in Harlem.
Uh-huh.
I grew up in East Harlem, and I just couldn't get away from people.
No way to
get. There was a social order there, a pecking order, where, you know, just people were on top of you. So, I mean, for instance, I go to a city gym on the east side where you have extremely civilized people. You have all different classes, all different types of people there. The most civilized people there aren't interested in each other. They read newspapers and books, and we avoid each other. We smile at each other. We acknowledge each other's existence, and that's about it. We're not interested.
And that's the way you'd like it to be.
Well, yeah. Because
you'd like it to be a mind-your-own-business society, because
well,
I'm tired
I'm
of people being in my business.
Yeah, after studying sociology and psychology and philosophy and history and everything else, what is their interest in? I mean, I feel like Hamlet at this point. Man delights me not, right?
Well, you could feel that way.
Possibly interested in an imperfect creature.
Oh, I'm fascinated by imperfect creatures.
Oh, you are?
Sure. That's what I do.
So you're an eavesdropper.
No, I'm more of a listener. People tell me. I don't have to overhear it.
Yeah, but you do it to help people.
That's right.
Yeah, you're a healer. So that's different from just being like someone who's just interested in people's business for some sort of thrill or power.
John, I could hear the pain it caused you. Did you come from, were there many people in your family?
No, there was just a nuclear family, and that's it. And then the rest of the society had land, and there were definite boundaries there.
But when you lived in Harlem?
I ran around in a group, in a gang.
In a gang.
I had to belong to a gang, and then within the gang you had a pecking order.
And everybody's business was known.
Of course, because you had to be part of the pecking order, which is part of the greater society, right? As you grow up in American society, there is a pecking order.
It doesn't change very much. We're still part of a gang.
Yeah.
John, I want to thank you very much for calling in.
Yeah, okay, thanks.
Sure. 212-209-2900. You know, I can imagine if you're one of many children and privacy, what it must mean to a young girl talking to a girlfriend or a boy trying to talk to his friend. That's why I think texting became so popular. You could do it and not be overheard, you know? 212-209-2900. This is Armand DeMille. Let's take another call. Hi, you're on the air.
Yes, I'm James from the Bronx.
Hello, James.
I have two questions. One is, what is the letters OCS? It used to be CIA. It is CIA now, but it was one time called OCS.
Yes.
Like
yes, it was.
And the second question is, when did intelligence become the major thing in this country, where you had to be somewhat concerned about Big Brother watching?
So intelligence became how much you're listening in, what we call intelligence. You know what I mean? Military intelligence is how much I know about you that you don't know I know. That's military intelligence. You're right, it's all over the world. But you see, this has always been. This has been the people's power. It's been the power of one tribe over another tribe. How much do I know about you that you don't know I know about you, and therefore I know where you're vulnerable. I know where I could strike you, and I know where I could win if I need to win. It certainly has gotten weird, hasn't it,
yes,
James?
Yes, it has.
Now,
if I may say, at what point was it, the 1800s, early 1900s, where intelligence became the somewhat dominant factor in the United States?
Well, you know, you have to think about it on one level. If you were going to decrease violence and now have a threat all the time, now just knowing that you have weapons may stop me from trying to hurt you because you could hurt me back. So maybe it's not such a bad thing that intelligence, rather than pure force, became the shift. I'm not sure. I'm not making a case for either one, but I can see both sides.
Right, right. Now, what do these letters, these OCS, stand for, before CIA was?
Well, that's really not for me. That's the Organization of Something States, I remember. But
So that's what it means.
Yeah. So thank you very much for calling in.
Okay, thank you.
Sure, James. 212-209-2900, Armand DeMille. Hi, you're on the air.
Hello.
Hello.
As you were talking earlier, Armand, about the telephone conversations.
Yeah.
I recalled a very short story, maybe two pages long, by Franz Kafka, about his having a telephone on the wall of his apartment, and which was opposite exactly to a telephone on the other apartment, and about of an individual who lived there who had a very important part to play in Franz Kafka's life. It's an extraordinary story in such a short span.
Do you remember the name of the story?
I do not. It's part of that little green Shokin books.
Yeah, edition. I just, you know, you wouldn't believe it. I just bought that as a gift for someone for Christmas.
I do believe it.
I just bought that collection story because I wanted them to
read.
Get
out of here.
I wanted them to read The Burrow.
The Burrow, yes.
Burrow is one of my favorite stories.
Uh-huh.
It's really a great description of the Depression.
And this is a great description of terror and eavesdropping. It's a quintessential.
I'll have the book waiting for me when I get home.
Briefly about my eavesdropping, I recall as I'm sitting here listening to your very interesting guest and what a fascinating subject, a time when I was about 12 years old. At night, I could hear my parents in the primal act.
Yeah.
And I used to stand. We lived in a railroad apartment in the South Bronx. I used to stand, get out of bed. I slept with my younger sibling in the same bed. I would ease myself out of bed, stand by the doorway, and masturbate to hearing my parents.
Sure, and what would you listen for them saying? Would you try to, I mean, was it just the sound of it that turned you on?
The sound of the bed, their voices. They didn't, they were Russian immigrants, and they spoke mostly Russian. And just, you know, the oohs and the ahs and the so on, which was kind of on the border of pain, pain and ecstasy.
Sure.
Yeah. That's
sure.
It.
Sure, and I think you're not alone, by the way. I think I've heard this story.
Oh, I'm not? I thought I was.
No, I've heard the story from many people who would listen to their parents having sex. And it was like, perhaps that was the original, what we listen to that we never talk about.
Yeah.
I mean, is that part of being a parent, being quiet? Shh, the children will hear?
I think, I don't know. Part of being a parent is knowing how to abstain, I guess, when the children are within earshot.
Thanks for calling
in. Thank you very much.
Sure.
Bye.
212-209-2900. That's it. I mean, I would remember that now. Every child must have eavesdropped on their parents. I remember one man who told me he called his cousin over because he heard his mother and father having sex. And he called his cousin over, and the cousin came over to sleep over because it was on a Tuesday night. So they figured it was on Tuesday night, so it must happen on Tuesday nights. So the cousin would come over on Tuesday night, and the two of them would lay awake to listen. But then it didn't happen again on Tuesday night, and they were kind of disappointed. And then it happened on a Thursday. And he called up his cousin, and he said, it happened on a Thursday. And the cousin said, well, I'll just sleep over there on Tuesday and Thursday. What are kids going to do? They're trying to make up the rules. 212-209-2900. This is Armand DeMille. Let's take another call. Hi, you're on the air.
Good afternoon, Armand.
Hi there.
How are you?
Good. Five men. I like this. Five men have called so far.
Five men, that's good. I'm just calling to wish you and your family happy holidays. And
thank you so much.
Very sorry you're not on the radio more often.
Uh-huh.
And that's all.
Okay.
Well, good afternoon. Thank you.
Thank you. 212-209-2900. Let's take another call. Hi, you're on the air. Hello there.
Yes?
Yes, good. There you are. Hi.
Hello?
Hello. Can you turn off your radio, please?
Okay. Hello?
Yes.
Am I on the air?
You are on the air.
All right.
We're all listening to you.
Okay, it's okay. I see all men have called, but I am a sociologist, and I think you've got two sides of your argument. One, you know, the kind of kid who listens in on their parents, which is one way to look at it. But the other way is a kind of cultural shift lately, but I think it's shifting back again, where people don't, it's almost a kind of invade, they don't have a sense of themselves as whole people with a sense of their own privacy. And then people either think it's okay to invade. That's different from secretly listening in versus having your privacy invaded.
Yes, I hear you. So was it, what about, wait a minute, so what's the difference between the two for you?
It's an interesting, sometimes a kid has no choice. They're in their room and the parents are whatever they're doing and, you know, they just happen to be there and they're kind of laughing and giggling as a kid anyway, as opposed to, that show, I think it's War of the Roses, where they call the person up on the phone who a caller calls in and says that they think that their girlfriend or spouse is cheating on them, and they call them up on the phone and try to trick them into admitting that they're having something when they're not, or they are. And that, to me, is somewhat of an invasion of someone's privacy, and people are laughing at it.
Have you had any personal experience with any of this?
No.
No, this is just as a sociologist, right?
Yeah.
So you've never had, as a kid, you've never had any particular interest in hearing your parents or hearing what
you're saying? I think as a kid, we all are. I mean, I can't, it's the kind of thing where I think, I remember being on a vacation looking out the window and someone was walking nude. I was in Europe and someone was walking nude on a balcony and we were laughing. I was with my mother and a friend and it was funny, but it was an accident. It was not something that one deliberately does or deliberately tries to hurt another human being I wonder if there are many people walking around who don't have a sense hey, this belongs to me and I don't want to share it.
Right. That's kind of the point that John Locke was making a little earlier.
Yeah.
There's also the part of us that wants to be streakers. There's also the part of us that wants to be out there to be seen and to be overheard. We want to exist. We want to make an impression on someone's mind.
If you're talking about a kind of culture of celebrity, I think you're right. I mean, you look at People magazine. And
but I think almost everyone wants to be acknowledged and recognized in some way.
I think you're right.
Yeah. Well, I thank you. What's your name, by the way?
Robin,
I want to thank you very much for calling in.
I'm going to
take one more call. 212-209-2900. This is Armand DeMille. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, Armand.
Hi there.
Bridget.
Hello, Bridget.
And I love your topic, and I was thinking about all the varying levels of etiquette involved.
Yeah, here we go. Shopping. Good. Good, yes.
And I'm 50 years old. I have three sisters. And one of our eavesdropping etiquettes, which my parents completely enforced, was if anybody read anybody else's diaries, which we all wrote in them, it could not be used against you. Where'd you get it? The diary. You should not be reading the diary. Does not count. Period. The end.
Right. They didn't forbid you from reading the diaries.
Well, that was inherent. But if you did, you couldn't. They were not going to give it any power at all.
What a strange thing. I mean, would it be a thing that they would instill in you, reading these diaries is not allowed?
Because it's private. It's like the unsaid
words. Yeah, but instead of that,
they
said, but if you do read...
That's true.
Right? Don't read, don't believe. It's a little like don't ask, don't tell. If you read, you don't believe.
Or even if it's 100% true. I mean, even if you had written, I don't know, I stole $2 from my sister, guess you're not going to get that $2 back because how you got that information was considered more criminal. In other words, to not honor someone's privacy for their journal in my household, that it actually had was more sacrosanct than, say, stealing my sister's dimes or
sure,
something.
Sure, but
like
it still has that little odd component to it.
Assuming why would you're going to be bad, right?
Why would they just not say, hey, of all the things we believe in here, you should not invade the other person's privacy. It's not allowable.
I never thought of it that way. You're absolutely right. It was assumed, I guess, we weren't going to be obedient.
Thank you very much for calling in. What's your name?
Bridget,
thanks again. Thank you.
Thank you. Bye.
I what? I. 212-209-2900. Enough time for one more call. Let's take it. Hi, you're on the air.
Hey, Armand. Hey, this is Reggie. How's it going?
Hey, Reggie. Nice. How nice.
Man, I'm glad I got you. I was on the bus heading home from your office today.
Yeah, I saw your beautiful face today.
Yeah, thanks a lot. Man, I tell you, this girl was talking on her phone real, kind of low, but she was talking about she's going to be late to work, and then she was complaining about one of her friends having to take the bus back home because her friend wasn't driving her home. But I just got in, I just started listening. I said I wasn't going to listen, but I ended up listening to her whole conversation and everything else. She's going to talk to people about not giving people rides or whatever. She just went on, but it was, I just got it. It's a funny thing. I was on a bus today, and this is what they were talking about.
Well, it's a nice thing. You know, Reggie, sometimes you don't have to bring a book anymore. You could just listen in. Yeah. The drama's all around you.
It is.
Hey,
it is.
Reggie, thanks for being our last caller.
All right.
You're beautiful
to
see you today.
Happy
yes.
Holiday.
Same to you. We're going to be going now, my friends. I will be back with you on Tuesday next, and then I'll be with you on Tuesday and Wednesday of next week. But do tune into the Facebook of The Positive Mind, and you'll hear more stuff than we even broadcast.
So much for tuning in.